On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Hello, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence. And of course, the intelligence comes from the guests that I'm interviewing. And we're really fortunate to have Dee Watkins, a 34-year-old writer who came to some notoriety and got a big fan base on the internet, writes for Salon. And he's written a terrific book called The Beast Side, Living and Dying While Black in America. And I must say, I reread it today. It's a fast read, about 150 pages, brilliantly written. And I use that word advisedly. And I'd just like to ask you about the voices that are in this book, because there seem to me at least three or maybe four distinct perspectives. And that's what makes it so interesting. One is someone who grew up in a very rough part of Baltimore, the Beast Side, and actually, despite being a good student, dropped out of college, despite good SATs, or as you put it, relatively good SATs coming from your neighborhood, and got into your brother, your late brother's occupation. He had been killed, and you got involved in drug selling and so forth. But then there were these, and that voice is quite prominent in the book, that reality. And you say there are two Baltimores, as there are two parts of every city, black and white, and you say the two will not really ever meet. Then there are these other voices. There's a voice of someone who goes on to get a master's in education at Johns Hopkins, a very famous school. And you also get a master's in creative writing at the University of Baltimore, where you teach creative writing. And the strength of this book is you've got it all. Was it difficult writing it to keep those voices separate, or are they all part of one? Why don't you just sort of tell me where you're coming from in this book?
I think that we are all multi-layered. A lot of times we get forced into these boxes where people want us to be one thing. Is he a black academic? Is he an activist? Is he, you know, an ex-street guy? What is he? And I'm all of these things. And I think we all have these layers, and we could do a better job at embracing them. And I try my best to represent the many different ways I feel and the many different parts of my story in the book.
In that spirit, let me go to the first voice, and you say, we are all American dream chasers. And one thing your book takes on is the sort of idea of throwaway people, of the people who actually live in a ghetto community, who live in black America or lower class, discriminated against black America. And you present such a vivid image of life in the community, of people, you know, working endlessly at something, whether it's legal or illegal, whether it's the grandmother cooking for everyone and working at different jobs, or it's the kid hustling drugs on the street corner. And it's a very interesting view of a kind of vitality, often a thwarted vitality, but it challenges the basic myth that there's somehow these people have just sort of lost the lust for life. And the thing that drives the book is that these are complex, interesting, highly motivated people, maybe more so than any other group of people.
One of the things in America that we failed to do was talk about that shared culture. One thing that we as black people don't really get is a chance to show that we buy into this whole American idea of the hero story, right? There's a hero story. One of the reasons why many of the things that exist within this country, and I'm talking about like slavery and you know, the genocide with Native Americans and all of these different things are left out of the narrative when we're teaching history to our young people, is that it doesn't fit well into the hero story. So, you know, regardless if you're African American, if you're a white person, if you're Asian American, Latino, whatever, but you're being brought up in American culture, you're going to highlight all of the things that represent the best in your culture, and you're buying into that same narrative of the hero story, whatever that hero looks like based on whatever community you come from.
But one of your reminders in the book is that it is not a common heritage, and you use the example of the Star Spangled Banner singing the national anthem and at sporting events and leaving out a key part. Can you tell us that story again?
When most people think of the Star Spangled Banner, they think of it as one song, one verse written by Francis Scott Key, but it actually was a poem in its four stanzas. In the third stanza, he has a line that says, "No hireling or slave should be free from the gloom of the grave." And he said that, you know, if I can loosely translate it, it was at the time there was a lot of slaves escaping the fight with the Brits, because they were promised freedom if the Brits won the war. And Francis Scott Key was disgusted by this. He thought that these slaves were ungrateful and they deserved to die because they were traitors on their country when they didn't really get a chance to experience the country in the same way as him. And that became so popular that Andrew Jackson actually rounded up a huge amount of slaves in Louisiana. And he said, "Look, if you guys protect Louisiana, you can be free after the war." And those slaves, you know, many of them lost their lives protecting Louisiana, and they weren't able to go free. He reneged on the deal and changed his mind. So I just feel like that song wasn't really meant for the black people in this country.
Even when you're successful, you've got the book contract, you're teaching at a college in Baltimore, nonetheless, you're stopped in a car, as you were harassed when you're going with a very famous actor, just walking down an alley. What are you doing in that neighborhood? What are you doing in that house? Well, it turned out you owned the house that you were entering, and you're still being hassled. So the book is a reminder that even though you have gone on to have these measures of success, you know, two master's degrees, you know, a book contract, being a professor of creative writing now, you're open to the same thing that happened to all of the people you list in your book who were killed, not because they confronted the police, but because they just were trying to stay out of trouble and were killed. And you have sort of a list running through the book. And Baltimore is very much the backdrop. And what has happened in Baltimore recently, obviously, very much sets the tone for this book.
Yeah, I think America needs to know that if you're a black person and you look a certain way, and you make a wrong turn, you can easily be added to the list of unarmed people who were murdered by police officers. Or, you know, because of how society works, because of systemic racism, because of how so many minorities and people of color are locked out of the workforce, you could potentially be killed by a person who looks just like you. All of these things work together. So, my job is, as a journalist and an author, is to just raise awareness on all of these issues, because a lot of people just don't know. We have a lot of different people fighting for, you know, who have similar beliefs as me, who are fighting on different fronts. You mentioned Two Live Crew earlier, but there's like this rap artist like Kendrick Lamar and like J. Cole who are talking about these things in their music, and there's filmmakers who are trying to get these ideas out too. And you know, the world needs to know, is America a great country? Yes. Are we amazing when it comes to innovation and creation and art and entertainment? Yes. You know, we're great, but at the same time, we have these dirty secrets that are attached to history. And if we truly want to be as great as we can be, then we need to solve them. We need better community police relations. We need more opportunity for everybody. And we need to do any and everything we can to enhance social relations.
Well, and it's an important lesson, educational moment for white people, as you point out in your book, where you give the examples of white privilege. I mean, one could be, you know, as the person who killed people in a church, and yet, you know, white person, Roof, his name, and they brought him dinner, and they were the police were solicitous of his well-being. And you have a sentence, which I wrote down here, saying, you wrote, talking about white privilege always makes white people uneasy, probably because no one wants to feel like they have an unfair advantage over another person solely based on skin color. And I must say, reading your book, because you have a description of the University of Baltimore, where you once went in your inner city school, and it reminded me very much of City College, where I studied as a kid, and I grew up in the Bronx, you know, a long time ago. And there's a part of you as a white person growing up that way wants to think, hey, you know, we all had it rough. We all had to come up the hard way, or at least many of us do. But what your book is just a reminder, not only a reminder that maybe in some ways the situation is worse now, because at least earlier you had the civil rights movement and there was, you know, obvious recognition that had to be of the role of prejudice. And at the same time, you had a job market that was expanding and black people could get those jobs, indeed were needed for those jobs, beginning with the war effort and so forth. The sub-theme of your book is that poverty, as it particularly plays out for the black community, is the inhibitor, is the grinding, destructive force here.
You know, one thing I never try to do myself is, like, I never try to disrespect any person's struggle. So if you're a white guy and you grow up in a rough neighborhood and you're from a single parent home and you fight your way through college and you make a career for yourself, great. You know, I'm just here to say that a black guy from the same, from, you know, and that's nothing, no disrespect to that white guy's resiliency or the things that he needed to be successful. But a black guy with the same reality might not have some of those opportunities based on policy, along with systemic racism and how these things work. They did a study in Baltimore, 35-year study by a doctor named Carl Alexander. He published his findings in a book called The Long Shadow, where he followed 800 poor people, and he found that poor blacks have it way, way worse than poor whites. As a black person in Baltimore City, 97% of the people born in poverty die in poverty. A black person with no jail and some college has less of a chance of getting a job than a white person with some felonies. And, you know, these things are accomplished through networks, through social fabric, through the ability to pass the job on to my buddy's son and things that a lot of black people in this country couldn't establish or didn't establish or weren't really able to establish for a number of reasons. We can talk about education. We can talk about gentrification. We can talk about the destruction of a social fabric that gentrification brings. But, you know, I think that the B side is it had a number of purposes. Yeah, I definitely agree with what you said, but, you know, just to add on to that, it's a love story to black people who never ever ever get a chance to see themselves in a contemporary book, and it's also a guide for white people who are from areas that are far removed. It delivers a glimpse of humanity that sometimes the media does a great job at leaving out. One of the most amazing things that happened was, and I wasn't even expecting this because I'm not like a glory hog type of guy. I'm more like a regular kind of just everyday guy. But I went into a high school to address a group of kids, and they loved the B-side so much that they painted a picture of me that wrapped the whole hallway. It was crazy. Like, I've never, ever thought anybody, this book would touch, you know, a group of young people so much. And when I saw that, I was frustrated at a lot of different things, but it just made me stop and say, you know what, you're doing the right work, you're doing your job, You don't need to focus on the literary world. You don't need to focus on fame, or you don't need to focus on, you know, little cocktail parties and trophies. You're creating a book that's getting young people excited about reading. You're doing the job. Pat yourself on the back. And that was the first time I actually ever celebrated anything that had anything to do with writing in my whole career.
One of the strengths of this book is it makes it clear that you can do all the right things that society, you know, claims when it says no mind, mind is a terrible thing to waste, and we should really try and have magnet schools and so forth. But you point out that it cuts across class when you're black, and there's an interesting study. It's funny because in one page in your book, you say here, I remember asking my friend Ron from West Baltimore about the recession after the market crashed in 2008, and he laughed, quote, recession? What recession? Everything is the same around here. But one of the things about this Great Recession is if you look at the Federal Reserve study, and I've mentioned this on other shows that I've done, by the Federal Reserve of St. Louis, that black people lost. The black community that had gone to college, graduated from a four-year college, did everything right, they lost 70% of their worth, not just their income, their worth. And brown people lost 60%. Why? Because they were targeted for these lousy home loans. They were targeted to be ripped off, you know, get the liar's loans and all this thing. And one of the points you raise in your book, speaking as an educator, as somebody who's gotten his master's in that field, you raise the question, maybe that's what we're educating for, that maybe, you know, we don't really, the schools are broken by design.
It's, you know, it's really, really simple. If you look at how these schools are tax-based and we're running off this same system, you know, and we're not really doing anything to fix it. We're not really making changes. You can walk in a school. You can walk into a school that's in an affluent neighborhood in the suburbs or something like that, and then you can walk in a school in a black neighborhood and easily tell the difference. A lot of people call me a conspiracy theorist when I was talking about social reproduction. Social reproduction isn't my idea. This idea has been around for a long time. To sustain capitalism, you must create a permanent underclass. That's how this country works. You do that through education. You do that through housing. You do that through discriminatory policies. It's very simple. As far as the housing crisis, I was disgusted, you know, when I found out the amount of African Americans, black and brown people who lost their homes in comparison to everyone else. But if you even look at like a lot of things that are being published today, you know, in this country, a white person with a median income of around $40,000 can afford to live in a neighborhood with black people with a median income of around $100,000. And how do these things play out? I don't know. Is it all a coincidence? I don't think so. But still, do it all. One of the things that I'm doing, one of the things that I've been working on with fellow activists is promoting ownership. Do all of it. Ownership. You know, why are we making it? Why are we becoming successful? You know, for those of us who are lucky enough to obtain success, why are we leaving these neighborhoods? Why aren't we staying in these neighborhoods and buying these houses and recreating that social fabric and being the opportunity creators versus waiting for the government or some big, large company to create opportunities? Why aren't we being those people? If we can do that and we can dictate the market, then maybe we can avoid some of those things like what happened with the housing crisis in this country.
But, you know, in the book, you have a poignant description of your feelings about the victory of Barack Obama. And you say you were quite thrilled by it, but at the same time, somewhat disappointed. And we're now in the middle of an election season, and we're told, you know, oh, Hillary Clinton's got the black vote sewed up, and then you got the Black Caucus Political Action Committee saying this is the way to go, and so forth. And you raise some questions in the book about where is leadership. You have a dig at the ministers group that shows up every time, including Jesse Jackson, you know, showing up and every time there's a killing and, you know, but nothing changes. And I was really quite thrilled to get read in your book your tribute to Sister Soldier. I don't know if people remember Sister Soldier much. I actually interviewed her for Playboy magazine or for the LA Times when Bill Clinton maligned her. And you say in your book, "I wasn't hooked on books until I read Sister Soldier's The Coldest Winter Ever." And then you go on to mention other people. Could you just say a word about her? Because she's, you know, she's gone on to write a number of important books, but she's somebody who was demonized at a critical point by the very people in our political system who claim to have a great interest in helping black people.
The other day I tweeted that black people who vote for the Clintons are crazy. The Clinton policies jailed my whole family and all of my friends. It got like 500 likes and another 450 retweets. A lot of black people felt the same way. When I first saw Sister Soldier speak, it was way back in the day, back when she was like locked in with Public Enemy. And I remember her looking like women from my neighborhood, but when she opened her mouth up, she was just so political and intelligent and sharp, and I always remembered her. So a couple years later, when I first discovered the book, you know, I remembered her. I remembered that name and how she spelled Soldier, and I remembered all of that, and someone recommended it to me, and The Coldest Winter Ever, I didn't know you could write like that. Like, I didn't know that a person who had a reality, you know, different from mine but kind of similar because of the content of the book and then the knowledge and the jewels and the gems that she was dropping in that book. And then it was a page turner. And then I finished it in like 2 days and it was just, it blew my mind. And I just like, you know, from that point on, I was woke. I was like, yo, I did not know you could write like that.
Your book is an opening to people. It's really accessible to anyone who reads it without prejudice. What it's done is what, you know, Jesus does in Luke, the tale of the Good Samaritan. It reminds people that everyone out there has a soul. Every life is important. Everyone cares about their, I forget the way you put it, but everyone wants to be recognized and function and survive and succeed and everything else, that there's this common humanity. And that was, you know, unfortunately denied in our own constitution, whether the, you know, black people were fully human, and it's been denied at different times in our history. But your book exudes this great sense of common humanity. And I think that one incident for me, when Bill Clinton attacked Sister Soldier, I felt, wait a minute, are they going to destroy anyone who stands up, anyone who brings up a troubling reality, reminds us that we do have real problems? Are they just going to all be demonized? And I think, you know, right now in this election, I think it's sort of interesting that once again, we have this kind of, no, you have to fall in line and accept. And yet what you're falling in line and accept is really not a good thing, you know, Goldman Sachs, the banks, everything. I don't know. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it struck me when I got to that page in your book, you know, I thought, wow.
You know, that same hero story is going on. You know, even Bernie's your hero, or Hillary's your hero, or Trump's your hero, you know. You know, it's the same. It's that same hero story in a country that's so divided. It's so divided. It makes a lot of people, millennials especially, become disenchanted with party politics. You know, there's no middle ground. There's no shared culture. Even you love these people or you hate these people, and that's a huge problem. And that's something that you know, I wish we had a unifying candidate that could bring people together. But right now, even you know, you're red or you're blue. And, you know, I don't know how to get there, but I know you know, with the limited amount of power I have, and what I do locally is kind of like the only thing I could do to make a difference on that front. When I have speaking engagements and book events around Baltimore City, they tend to be mixed. You get black dudes from who are professionals and black dudes from the street, and you get white hipsters and rock band guys and white guys who are like, you know, yuppies, and some Asians and Mexicans, and you get a nice little mix of people. And some of my other friends who are in the art community in Baltimore, when we collaborate on things, we're bringing people together, and we're trying our best to enhance social relations through art and communication. But we still live in a super divided country. You know, I don't even know if black people go to Trump rallies. You know, it's like, it's crazy. And then some of the language used, make America America again. Like, I mean, we can read between the lines. We're not crazy. And I don't even, you know, even know how to get like a Hillary or a Bernie supporter to acknowledge some of the frustrations that exist within Trump supporters. Even, and I don't even know if they know what their frustrations are. They're just happy and mad. Like, I don't know, they're happy for him and then they're mad at everything else.
How do you go from the stark background that you describe in this book to having this open, you know, pro-life in the best sense of pro-life attitude? And actually, the book is, I recommend to everyone read the book. It's extremely well written, but it's also very positive, oddly enough. How did you survive? How did your positive attitude survive and actually get nurtured by this horrible experience of seeing so many of your friends killed and, you know, such a harsh reality?
I don't subscribe to this idea of obtain some success and move out to the suburbs and, you know, get a little picket fence and never go back. Like, I'm not into that. I love being in the city. It's a part of me and my character and the hugest part of my writing. And more importantly, I'm from the, you know, I honestly truly think that I'm from the tradition of Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass, whereas these are people who obtained freedom, but they still went back to try to help their friends and family members get the same thing. So I gotta go back into these high schools. I gotta be in these communities. I have to be in these places where people are going through the same struggles or even, you know, more, you know, like rougher situations at times, because I have to use my resources and what I know as a writer and what I know as an educator to get people excited about reading and to have love for their own stories and get them excited about telling their stories. And I have to partner with my friends who do the same thing in financial literacy, and my other friends who do the same thing in fitness, and my other friends who do the same thing with sports, right? We all have these different skills that we're good at. And I think it's our responsibility to work really, really hard to try to, you know, obtain mastery, and then take that mastery and share that skill with somebody who was never exposed to it. Because when I was growing up, I never knew a writer or a filmmaker or a photographer or basically anybody that didn't sell drugs or work for the city or was, you know, like a homeless guy or something. I didn't really know people that really dreamt of being professional artists and professors and things like that. So I have to be in these places so a little kid can say, oh yeah, that's due to college professor. Oh, homeboy, you know, he write articles for newspapers and all that. So me being accessible and me being visible is helping them. And that's where my positivity comes from.
The word gentrification. I live in downtown LA, and, you know, and a part of me welcomes gentrification. You know, we didn't have a supermarket for a long time, you know, and you want these things. And on the other hand, what your book describes is really the destruction of another community and a way of avoiding thinking about other people. What's happening to places like Baltimore or, you know, Brooklyn, New York, or other places where we have a model now of, you know, saving the city by destroying the home of a lot of people who used to be able to live a good life in the city?
You know, saying yes to something is always saying no to something else. And, you know, when I write that article, people always, like, you know, or people who don't really fully understand the article, you know, I guess because they skim it in the age of attention deficit disorder or whatever. But I'm not anti-gentrification. I'm not against it. My issue is, why would you ride past, and this is for a city like Baltimore, this is a different model from Brooklyn because it's different everywhere, but in Baltimore, why would you ride past 8 blocks of boarded up homes to 8 blocks of homes where people have been there for generations and force them to move without fixing the boarded up houses that are already there? It doesn't make any sense. The main thing that makes me upset about gentrification is the destruction of social fabric. And what that basically means is, you know, let's just say if I live on Durham Street and across the way from me, there's a guy named Joe, and Joe has a nephew that's getting in trouble. And Joe comes to me and he says, D, man, my nephew, he's getting in trouble, man. And I know you were a plumber. Can you teach him how to be a plumber so that he can get a job and, you know, we can keep him out of jail? So I say, sure, Joe, no problem. And I bring in Joe's nephew. I teach him how to be a plumber. He's making a livable wage and he works with me for maybe a year or two. And he knows enough to start his own business. So now he has his own business and he needs some new plumbers that he can pull from the neighborhood, the community. And he can bring them in and grandfather them in and teach them the system. And we're sharing those skills and people are working. And that's what social fabric does. It gives you a group of people to watch your kids when you go on a job interview or on a date or whatever you're trying to do. It gives you some people you can borrow money from, some people you can go in business with. It, all of these different things exist within these communities. And it doesn't matter if it's homeowners or not. Social fabric exists within communities, and outside people who buy up and board those and demolish these neighborhoods don't really understand that. And in Baltimore City, it's happened in mostly black neighborhoods. Now, the flip side of that is it has happened in some white neighborhoods, but it mostly happened in black neighborhoods. And the flip side of that is in a place like Baltimore City, let's just say that social fabric is destroyed. It's not like New York City. I can't take a train. You know, if they move me to one side of town, I can't take a 15, 20 minute train to go see my friend. To get from East Baltimore to West Baltimore by bus, it takes a month. It's the worst public transportation in the country. I guarantee it. Worst public transportation in the country. I went to a housing project reunion party. We have those. And I saw two people talk. They didn't see each other in like 10, 15 years just because the public transportation is so bad and they don't have cars. So gentrification is great for bringing businesses to areas, to fixing up deplorable and messed up homes and all of these different things. But when you're ripping apart established communities while driving right past communities that aren't, you know, that are vacant, then you're letting us know that you're just trying to displace black people and black neighborhoods and create an infrastructure to do what you want to do. And that's not the right way to do it. There's a right way to do it and a wrong way to do it. And I think our city has been doing it the wrong way.
I think this book is coming at a really important time because in the United States now, the question is, are we going to take care of people? Are we going to give them the opportunity or are we going to outsource them? You know, that's really what you're talking about. And are you going to, you have some really, you know, we've had a nice chat here, but you have some very depressing images in this book about how we treat people, the militarization of the police, the constant harassment, the killing of innocent young people, the hostility and this image of the pipeline school. I wanted to end on a positive note, but your book is really a powerful reminder of how we have failed as a culture and why with any sense of humanity, we should, you know, reverse course. So this is Robert Scheer for Scheer Intelligence. I've been talking to D. Watkins, the author of The Beast Side, Living and Dying While Black in America. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Our producers are Joshua Scheer and Rebecca Mooney, our engineer, Kat Yore, and Sebastian Grubar at USC's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism, with a special thanks to station WYPR in Baltimore.